Okay, so today we're into the really interesting part of this whole discussion. We have been looking at, with Peter Ackroyd, what happened in the exile and how that transitioned into restoration, the 400 years before Yeshua. Then we looked at Schiffman's book about how the text was massaged in order to get through the Tanianic and Amoritic periods, which led to modern Judaism. So we've seen that transition. And now Christine Hayes comes along and asks a really important question, because we've been battling with this question. And that question is, what do we do with the idea of law?
David, how do I?
If your microphones are on, please, you know, mute them so that I'm not picking up the background. Anyway, so now Christine Hayes is asking, and the title of her book is, What's So Divine About Divine Law? But the interesting part about this is that we've skirted this topic the whole time. You remember that Ackroyd talked about the natural propensity for people to add rules and laws as you go along, okay? And then Schiffman pointed out that that's exactly what happened in the Tanaitic period, that the sages expanded the idea of the law to cover more and more actions in human life in order to standardize it the way the community would behave and worship, etc. And that's essentially what happened when the oral Torah was eventually took over the role of the written Torah as the standard for the way that people interpreted what behaviors were required. Okay. So now we have this really interesting question from Hayes, which is, okay, how does that idea differ from the kind of understanding that the Greco-Roman world has of law? And then what does that mean ultimately for how we interact with scripture, with God's perspective, and finally with the whole idea of what's expected of us? Okay. So we're just going to jump right into this, and you will see the complexities that are involved in a simple question like, what is the law? Okay. So we start. Divine law. This is how she starts her book. Divine law can be minimally defined as the idea that the norms that guide human actions are somehow rooted in the divine realm. Okay. Now that what she has not specified is what the divine realm is. Okay. Don't think that the divine realm means the Bible. What she's talking about is the relationship between laws that we consider coming from some sort of divinity and how they're connected, okay, to that divinity, okay? And then she says, in much Greek thought, divine law is divine because it expresses the profound structures of a permanent natural order. Okay? Now notice what's happened here. This is really important because this is the paradigm shift between the Hebraic, biblical, scriptural view of law and the Greco-Roman view of law that we have inherited in the Western world. Okay? That is, that from the Greek perspective, law is divine because it reflects the rational order of the universe, not because it came from a divine lawgiver, but because it is reasonable, okay? Because the structure of the universe is rational, and if the law reflects that rationality, then it's divine, okay? She says, by contrast, according to biblical tradition, the law is divine not by virtue of an inherent quality, but because it emanates from a God who is master of history. Okay, so here you have the two views of law, which, by the way, are going to affect, from this point on, from the end of the Amoritic period, are going to affect the difference between the church and the synagogue. Okay, the two different points of view, because the church is ultimately going to adopt a Western view, a sort of modified Western view. Okay. The Greco-Roman view is the law is divine because it's rational. The Hebrew view is the law is divine because God said it. And by the way, that doesn't mean that it's rational. Okay? On the Greek side, if the law is not rational, it isn't a law. on the Hebrew side, a law can be non-rational. It can be contradictory. It can be unexplained. It can be unreasonable, but it's still a law because it came from God. Okay? Big difference. Okay? Now, next one. Ancient adherence to biblical tradition would have answered the question, so what's divine about divine law, by pointing to its origin in the divine will, a will expressed in history rather than nature. And this is really important because the Greek view is that essentially nature is what determines what's divine. Okay? The Greeks defined the word physis, nature, as everything except me. In other words, I'm the independent observer of all of reality, and all of reality is governed by what we call natural law, or what we would call today scientific law. And from the Greek perspective, that natural law itself is divine because it reflects a certain view of the universe, that the universe is not chaotic, that the universe is not random, that the universe has laws that govern it, okay? So she goes on. A crucial feature of all these discourses and practices is their presumption of a dichotomy between the unwritten natural or divine law on the one hand and the positive human law on the other, a dichotomy not immediately apparent in biblical discourse where the law of God is the written law of the community. Okay, so let's stop right there. So what she's saying is this, and we're going to hear this again and again. The Greco-Roman view of the divine law is a law that is not written. Why? Because it resides in your reason. Because it's what a thinking person assumes is the case. Okay, you don't write it down. Okay, and in fact, in the Greco-Roman world, written laws are human expressions and subject to the whims of the community, subject to enforcement, subject to all of the things that you hear negatively about the law. Divine law, which is a reflection of the way that the universe is put together, can't be written because it's beyond all written law, and because it's reasonable, any thinking person will agree to it. So you don't need to write it down. Okay? She says, thus, all Greco-Roman constructions of divine law begin with the common premise: divine law and human law possess different and usually diametrically opposed traits. The divine or natural law, in addition to being unwritten, is generally portrayed as rational and universal, corresponding to truth conducive to virtue, and static or unchanging. Okay, so let's stop right there. Because here are the characteristics of the Greco-Roman law. One, it's rational. Two, it applies universally to every human being. It's not selective. It isn't for the Jews or the Gentiles. It's what is true for everyone. Okay? Three, it doesn't change ever, because it's built on the fundamental laws of the universe, and they don't change, okay? And four, incorporating those ideas into your own personal behavior means that you will become virtuous, okay? It leads to virtue, okay? I didn't say it leads to worship. I didn't say it leads to obedience. It leads to virtue, okay? All right. By contrast, here's the rest of the quote. Human positive law takes the form of concrete rules and prohibitions which can be set in writing. It does not, of necessity, possess any of the characteristics that are inherent in the very concept of divine law from the Greek perspective. It will contain arbitrary elements that do not correspond to the truth, and it must be enforced coercively. It is particular and subject to variation, and its ability to produce virtue is a matter of considerable debate. Considerable debate. Okay? So, notice how the opposite of the Greco-Roman law is defined: written, arbitrary, enforced, and particular. What does that remind you of? it reminds you, of course, of the Mosaic Law, which is exactly that. Written, enforced prohibitions, right? Changeable and particular for the Jews. So from a Greco-Roman perspective, the whole idea of presenting the Torah as a way of life was diametrically opposed to everything that the Greeks believed. It wasn't a matter of me objecting to some of Moses, you know, Moses' instructions. That wasn't the point. The point was that the whole idea of a written law coming from God that was enforceable, that was changing, that was written down, was antithetical to what the Greeks believed law should be about. Because law should be about whatever a thinking man rationally agrees with the universe, and it's applicable to everyone. Okay? So you can see there are two fundamentally different ideas of law going on here. And what's really interesting is to see how the religious community of the Jews and the Christians adopted or resisted those two different notions. Okay? So we'll continue. This, she says, culminates in the writings of Philo, who identifies the Mosaic Law with the natural law and confers upon it the attributes of truth, rationality, truth, universality, and fixity. Okay? So this is really interesting, because what she's saying is Philo, who's a Jew in Alexandria, is really a Hellenized Jew. Remember what Schiffman and Aykroyd say, right? Jews that were infected with the Greco-Roman idea. So what does Philo do? He has a commitment to the Mosaic Code because he's Jewish, right? And so what he does is he tries to show that the Mosaic Law is in fact a Greco-Roman law, right? And in fact, it is rational, true, universal, and static, right? So his attempt is to take the Mosaic Code and demonstrate that it really fits the requirements of the Greco-Roman world, because he's trying to Hellenize it. Okay? He isn't the only one who does this, by the way. A whole bunch the history of the church is made up of men who are trying to work Hellenism into the Jewish Mosaic idea. Okay? Now look what she says about Paul. Paul made the opposite move and applied the Mosaic Law, various motifs from Greco-Roman discourses of human positive law. Paul represents the Mosaic Law as particular, temporary, non-rational, and not conducive to virtue. Particularizing the Roman law enables Paul to argue that it does not obligate the Gentiles. Paul's strategic adoption of positive law discourse in connection with the Mosaic Law would set the stage for a Christian discourse of denigration and delegitimization of the Mosaic Law. So she reads Paul, like most Christians read Paul, as anti-Jewish. And so she adopts the view that Paul believes that the law does not apply to Gentiles. Why? Because Gentiles are the universal man, the Greco-Roman man. And what she claims Paul is doing, I don't agree with her, but what she claims Paul is doing is showing that the particular Jewish population is still under the law because of the divine lawgiver, but Gentiles don't need to follow the law because they're under the Greco-Roman view of the universality of a certain kind of ethics. Okay? So we're going to see how she plays this out. This is right at the beginning of the book. She literally spends hundreds of pages on this development. Okay? Now let's continue. How to situate positive human norms and their claim to our fidelity in light of the universal divine law revealed in nature is a problem that Christianity acquires for itself and indeed for the modern West. Okay? So she's just encapsulated our issue. And the issue is really simple. If divine law is really rational, true, static, and universal, then what do we do with all of these laws from Moses that seem so particular to the Jewish situation, that seem so historically based, that change as we go along? Remember what happens with the Tananim and the Amorim? They change as they go along, right? The The oral Torah allows flexibility, so the law changes. We're seeing how all this develops. And what she's saying is, look what happened. The church, invested as it was in Hellenism, tried to adopt itself to fit the Greco-Roman paradigm when they're dealing with the Mosaic Code. And obviously, they had two solutions. The first is to say the Mosaic Code doesn't apply anymore, right? As a result of Jesus' death and resurrection, the law doesn't apply to us, which they mean, of course, the particular changeable written law of Moses, okay? What does apply? Does that mean that people in the church just think they can do whatever they want? Of course not. They're Hellenists. They're Greco-Roman thinkers. And so their view of the law is the universal static, reflecting the order of the universe, right? For everyone, and rational, right? So the ethics of the church shifts in the direction of Hellenism and the Greco-Roman world away from the Mosaic Code, while the Mosaic tradition, through the rabbis and ultimately through the oral Torah, is trying to hang on to the particulars of Moses, of God's instructions to Moses. Okay? So let's look at the next quote. To those who accept the Greco-Roman conception of divine law, the idea that divine law is not self-identical with truth, is not rational, universal, and unchanging, is shocking, indeed laughable. Okay? So this is really interesting, because you see, this is exactly what the church fathers did. They said, wait a minute, the law must be rational, universal, unchanging, and true. Therefore, anything that Moses gives us and that comes through the Jews that doesn't meet those requirements is not, it's not just shocking, it's unacceptable, because it doesn't fit the paradigm. Okay? So here we have the conflict coming more into focus. Okay? She goes on. The biblical character El, or Elohim, or Yahweh, is not consistently represented by the biblical writers as possessing the attributes assigned to the deity referred to as God by the late tradition of Western theology. And we already know that, right? For example, she says, in many narratives, this biblical deity lacks the attributes of omniscience and immutability. But of course he does, because omniscience and immutability are Greek philosophically based theology that weaves its way into the thinking of the now Gentile-dominated church and becomes the standard for how we approach issues of what God requires in behavior. It's not part of, until the influence of Hellenism, it's not part of the Jewish culture at all. And so Judaism doesn't worry about things like God saying that I have to come down and investigate Sodom myself because I'm not sure what's going on, and doesn't worry about the fact that God changes his mind over Nineveh, because it isn't part, the Greco-Roman philosophical theology of the church isn't part of Jewish thinking, okay? But for the Greco-Roman world, it's impossible to believe that God wouldn't know what was happening in Sodom, and it's impossible to believe that God didn't know in advance that Nineveh was going to repent, right? You get all those conundrums as a result of the philosophy that the Hellenistic culture brought with it. Okay, so biblical passages, she says, that lend themselves to a positivistic account of divine law. And what she means is the human idea of law being written in particular, are generally silent on the question of the law's correlation to a natural order or eternal truth. Right? In fact, the only passage that I can think of is the one at the beginning of Romans, where Paul talks about people acting against nature. But in fact, most of the time, the Bible in the textual documents that we have doesn't talk about the rational existence of the universe as a reflection of God's rationality. It has a different focus, okay? And she goes on. And present the law as expressing the will of a divine sovereign, as particularistic, non-rational, and evolving, coercive, and addressed to persons whose greatest virtue is unquestioning obedience. Okay? And you can think, that sounds pretty much exactly how the Bible approaches this. The law, as Moses gives it, is addressed to particular people, is coercive. You know, you shall do this, you shall not do that. It's built on reward and punishment, and the perfect subject is one who obeys without question. Okay.
Hey Skip. Just a quick question. I know this might sound stupid, but does the church believe in free will? That people have free will? Because those two things of free will and the God knowing everything kind of don't work together.
Yeah, that's a big problem. We won't address it here, but yes, that's one of the problems that occurs with the doctrine of omniscience is the attack on free will. So you know what the rabbis say: God is sovereign, man is accountable, and they don't even try to resolve it. Okay, but obviously Christianity tries to resolve it in multiple ways. And if you're really interested in all that stuff, you can read my doctoral dissertation on how that happened. But the point is that it's a big problem for Christianity because they have a transcendent God of divine attributes, from Aquinas, and then they have human reality. Okay, the Bible settles on human reality and rarely, if ever, talks about the conflict with the divine. All right, God in the Bible is treated as a co-participant in human history. But philosophical theology in the Hellenistic world doesn't view God like that. Okay, so let's continue. The norms, she says, the norms which the followers of such a God are required to observe are binding, not because they are an expression of an eternal and uncreated natural order, that would be the Greek view, but because they are commandments of God and have been deliberately enacted by him. In other words, the Hebrew view is, and you saw this when I used to write about Weizengott, Rabbi Weizengott. Basically what he said is this. If to behave properly is nothing more than the conclusion of rationality, then I don't need a God. Because I can come to determine what is right and wrong on my own, just by thinking about it. That's Plato and Aristotle's argument. Okay? But that's not the biblical view. And that's why he said the idea of sin is not an ethical idea. It's a religious idea. So sin is not the violation of some order in the universe. Sin is a violation of God's commandment, right? It's a religious concept, not an ethical concept. An ethical concept might be an argument for why a society can't survive if everyone lies, okay? That's a reasonable, rational argument. Doesn't depend on God saying, commanding you to tell the truth. But to tell the truth under God's command is a religious idea, right? And so there will be lots of cultures that don't follow the commandments that God gives, not because they're sinning, but because they don't adopt the religious perspective of Judaism. Okay? And this is a big problem because it means that the Jewish idea might be just so paradigm dependent that it doesn't apply to anyone else, as we will see. Okay? She goes on. Consequently, to violate the law is to defy the personal will of Yahweh. As Moshe Greenberg notes, God is directly involved as legislator and sovereign. The offense does not flout a humanly authored safeguard of cosmic truth, but an explicit utterance of the divine will. Okay? It's basically what I was saying, that the idea of sin, a violation of the commandments, is a religious idea, not an ethical one. It's not as though I'm acting against the nature of the universe. I'm doing something that's against the direct commandment of the lawgiver. Okay? So she goes on, specifically, divine law is represented as particular rather than universal, arbitrary rather than rational, evolving rather than static, coercive rather than instructive, and as addressed to obedient servants. Indeed, according to some passages, the divine law's purpose is precisely not to promote universalism and sameness, but to ensure the opposite, particularism and difference, right? Why would he say that? Because the divine law sets the Jewish believers in opposition to everyone else in the world, right? Following the divine law from a biblical perspective means that I no longer act like the rest of humanity. Okay? And she explains, next citation, because the law is not an eternal and static natural order, but an expression of God's will for a particular people in an ever-shifting historical time. Okay? So if I adopt that view, what it says is, once I adopt the Hebraic Jewish paradigm, my treatment of law will be determined by the Hebraic Jewish paradigm. And it won't matter if the instruction does not seem rational, seems contradictory, is not explained, doesn't have any universal application. It's because the paradigm says it's not about that. It's about obeying the sovereign God, no matter what the rational argument might be for or against. In short, she says, the biblical God is depicted as a God who changes his mind in response to the activity of human beings, not only in these prophetic proclamations, but also in narrative texts. And then she gives a whole long thing. And as his mind can change, so can his law. And this is a big problem for the Greeks, because if they believe that law is the expression of the eternal cosmic order, then it can't change. So if God is changing his mind, then he must also not be lawful, right? And by the way, this is how we get to the Gnostics, because the Gnostics say, in essence, the God of the Bible can't be the real God because he changes his mind, because he's not consistent, because he doesn't reflect the eternal rationality of the universe, right? Okay, so she goes on. In ancient Israel, the law's divinity was not perceived as entailing its fixity or absolute nature. Okay, this is really important, because we have a tendency as believers to think that God's will expressed in the law is absolute. But what she's pointing out, and what we'll see her develop in great detail, is that it's not. That it changes according to the historical circumstances. And therefore, we're the ones with one foot in the Greco-Roman world, believing that we need a law that never changes, and one foot in the Hebraic world, believing that God interacts in history and changes his mind. Okay? She goes on. The post-biblical claim that Yahweh's revealed divine law is fixed and immutable is not consistent with the Pentateuchal evidence. Do you understand what she just said? The post-biblical claim. Where does the post-biblical claim come from? The Christian church. The Christian church claims that Yahweh's revealed divine law is fixed and immutable. That's why we have attributes like immutability. But what she's just said is, that's not consistent with what happens in the five books of Moses. Right? For the biblical writers and redactors, the flexibility, evolution, and ever self-contradiction of divine law, or an even self-contradiction of divine law, do not appear to have impinged upon its authority and divine status. Okay? Now, what does that tell us? Well, we're all the way back to that book that we did by Kaufman. Remember when he talks about the fact that the text of the prophets includes prophecies which we know did not come true, but they were never redacted. Why? Because people believed that the prophets spoke from God, and therefore they didn't fix it. They didn't fix it to make it actually line up with history. They accepted the fact that it was a contradiction with the historical record and left it alone, because for them, it didn't matter that it wasn't lined up with the historical record. What mattered is that God said it. Enough. And if it didn't actually work out that way, it doesn't matter. Okay? In other words, the divine authority had nothing to do with the actual historical evidence. Okay? You got that? That's a huge, huge, huge issue. Because we from the West believe that divine authority is based on the correspondence between what the Bible says and what the truth is. But what Hayes has just told us is, if you look at it from the Semitic perspective, what God says doesn't have to have anything to do with what the truth is. It's what God says that matters. It doesn't matter if it comes out true or false in the historical record. Okay? So she goes on. It is Israel's duty and obligation to obey by aligning her will with that of Yahweh. In line with this view are biblical passages in which the ideal human type is the servant, the Eved, of unquestioning loyalty. Right? So, the Hebrew Bible may be said to refer to divine law in two modalities. The primary and dominant modality is that of the divinely revealed Torah, a set of laws delivered through Moses at Sinai. A second and much less explicitly attested modality of the divine law is that of a universal moral order that obligated humankind more generally. And we call that the Noahic laws. But remember, the Noahic laws were interpreted by the rabbis as universally applicable, and they are missing some really, really important things, like worshiping the one true God, right? It's almost as though if you follow the Noahic laws, you would automatically be in opposition to some of the critical obligations that you have as a believer in the God of Israel. Okay, so she continues. The text present the divine law revealed through Moses at Sinai as one, rational rather than non-rational. This is what the rabbis are trying to do. Two, static rather than involving. Three, static rather than involving. Four, instructive rather than coercive. And five, addressed to rational moral agents as ideal human types. When did that happen? When the rabbis adopted Hellenistic rational thinking, the Greco-Roman world, when that paradigm started to develop, then you have the development of the oral Torah and all the arguments back and forth to try to present Moses as rational. But Moses doesn't do that. Moses doesn't care if the commandments sometimes look contradictory. And I've written just recently about this. A passage in Deuteronomy that's in contradiction with the passage of Numbers on the Levirate marriage, okay? But Moses doesn't care. Why? Because his intention is not to show that the commandments given by God at Sinai are rational. They don't have to be rational. They just have to be given by God, okay? So, she continues. Despite the absence of explicit positive law prohibiting murder, Cain is culpable because the sanctity of human life is an implicit universal moral law. This is the argument of the rabbis, right? Because there is no law when the Cain story happens. There's no commandment about murder, right? Yet Cain is guilty or culpable. Why? As a matter of fact, that's a really good example because under the Mosaic law, Cain would have to be killed. But God doesn't kill him, right? I mean, we know what capital punishment was under the Mosaic Code, right? So why is Cain not treated in the same way that the Mosaic Code requires? And you could say, well, Moses hadn't given the law yet. But the fact of the matter is, Cain is still treated as culpable. So there must be an implicit universal moral law, the rabbis argue, right? And she says, it is not until Genesis 9:6 that the sanctity of human life is additionally expressed as a positive injunction of the divine will in the covenant with Noah. So in Genesis 4, Cain seems to be culpable for his action, but we have to wait till Noah before God even specifies that he's culpable, and we have to wait till Moses in order to find out what the required consequence is. And all along, these examples show us that there's something else going on in the text that doesn't fit the Greco-Roman world. Okay? Continues. The lawlessness, Hamas, here decried by Yahweh, refers not to the violence of positive laws divinely revealed. Indeed, no such revelation had yet occurred in the biblical narrative, but to the violation of the implicit and universal moral codes that make life in society possible. And of course, she's talking about what's happening before the Mosaic Code, right?
Skip.
Yes.
Skip. Just quickly, So there's actually a lot more, I didn't realize this, but now I see this. There's actually more flexibility in the Mosaic Hebraic code because, okay, so if your kids disobey, you can stone them, right? But that's like the end of it. You have all these other flexible things you can do before that, where right. our law is, this is the law and that's it. You know, where there's so much flexibility in Mosaic law.
Yes, and of course that's a problem, because the more flexibility there is, the less applicability there is, right? So now here's my problem. If the law is actually negotiable, if the law has flexibility, then how do I know what to do?
But then there's more forgiveness,
because
right?
Because every circumstance requires a little bit different application, doesn't it? Because no two circumstances are the same. No two human beings are the same. No two circumstances which involve ethical or moral requirements are exactly the same. So if I have a fixed law, right, you've just presented in case study exactly what the Greeks would say. What the Greeks would say is this. Listen, if your ethical behavior is based on a system where there's flexibility depending on every circumstance, then it can't be a reflection of the natural cosmic order, because in fact I will guarantee you that gravity never changes its mind. Okay? And therefore, the cosmic order shows that all underneath all of this is our fixed scientific laws. We would call them scientific today. They would call them cosmic. Those cosmic laws reflect what is actually true. So if you have a moral system where every circumstance is flexible, then it can't be divine. It has to just be human, because human beings change stuff all the time. But gravity never goes in reverse.
But see, I think the idea of each taking each situation, because people's motives are different for why they did something or, you know, what happened, or it's so different. It actually gives you a better chance of getting it right when it comes to consequences in some ways.
Yeah, except it also carries with it the chance of getting it wrong. Right? That's the whole point. If I am a Greco-Roman thinker and I want a divine law that's rational, universal, and static, it means that it's applied in exactly the same way every single time. It doesn't depend on the person, the circumstance, anything else. If you do this, then this happens.
Okay? But then, of course, still can get it. You can still get it wrong in the Greco-Roman world, right?
Yeah, but you can't get it wrong if the measure is did you apply the law exactly as it says? Okay. And by the way, Yeshua has a parable about this. Remember? He talks about the parable of the judge who just absolutely will not change the law because of the circumstances of the widow. Remember what he says? The judge basically is doing exactly what the judge is supposed to do. Not be influenced by the circumstances of the claimant. Right? Because if you're influenced by the circumstances of the claimant, then the law has no authority, because you never know what's going to happen next, right? And what's Yeshua's parable? That she pesters him so much that he actually gives in to her in spite of the fact that the law tells him that he shouldn't, right? And the parable, of course, is a parable about God and what God does, right? Yeah. But it's really, really different than the Greco-Roman world, because the Greco-Roman world says, says this, hey, listen. You kill someone in cold blood, you're executed. Of course, now in the human world, we change that all the time. But in the Greco-Roman world, if you had that kind of law, it would be applied every time, without exception.
Okay?
Yes.
That also, going along with this argument here too, that also influences our concept of what justice is, doesn't it?
Of course. The whole idea is at the end of as we work our way through Hayes's book, we're going to have to face the issue of, okay, so if the if from a Hebraic perspective, the law is particularistic and flexible, what does justice mean? When you say a God of justice, what do you mean? That he takes care of the Jews in their particular and evolving way? Right? What does it mean for the rest of the world? The Greco-Romans would say justice is the balance scales, right? Justice is always when you get the scale perfectly balanced, right? Here's the consequence, here's the action, here's the consequence. Always balanced perfectly, right? And by the way, we inherit this. The whole point of looking at this book is how much we have inherited a Greco-Roman view and think that it comes from the Bible, right? And what we're discovering, of course, is there's a lot more, as Phyllis points out, wait a minute, there's a lot more flexibility in the Bible than I ever imagined, because I thought that the Bible was absolute, static, universal truth, right? And now I'm discovering, oh my gosh, it's got all this other stuff going on. I got those concepts of absolute, static, universal truth from Greek philosophy, not from the biblical text.
So is that perhaps why we have the story of Jonah?
The story of Jonah is really interesting, isn't it? Because if you argue that God knew that Jonah was going to try to avoid going there and that Nineveh was going to repent, then the whole story is just a charade, right? So, I mean, it's got all kinds of complications in it. And by the way, Jewish scholars don't argue that God already knew all the things that were going to happen, because they would argue that God is a participant in the event itself, and that he literally does change his mind. No one from the Greek philosophical tradition could ever say that.
Okay? So, Skip.
Yes.
If we understand in the Bible that we are made in God's image and we accept that, and we're now understanding as we read the Bible that he changes his mind, things happen differently.
Yeah.
So if we accept this, then as I forget her name, I'm so sorry, I apologize. So what she is saying, I agree with. So we take full responsibility then. God is perhaps showing us we're to take full responsibility for our actions. And when we do something that is incorrect and that would hurt or cause destruction in the world, then we have to go back and we have to repent for this, whatever that would mean, whether it's behavioral or it's going to cost us financially, whatever it is. So God is actually helping us to change and to grow in his image as we are living now in this world. So that would explain to me the Hebrew language much better, that it is a changeable language according to the verbs that are put into place, and that each one of us is responsible for our growth. Would that seem reasonable? Or I shouldn't say reasonable.
I think that's half of the equation. The other half of the equation is I just recently wrote about the fact that in one of the passages in Scripture, God tells one of his prophets that he is deliberately giving the people wrong instructions so that they will be destroyed quicker. Right? What? I mean, how can you have a God who tells his people an evil Torah that will cause them to be destroyed quicker, right? I mean, that's about as flexible as you can get. But that means that my responsibility is tied up somehow with the will of God in a way that sometimes I can't even understand. So now you're right, Brenda, that a huge burden falls on my shoulders, because it's no longer possible for me to say, well, God knew it was all going to happen anyway, right? Now I am a participant in, as Hesha would say, I'm making history. That God is, look at the title of his book, God in Search of Man, right? God is waiting to finish the creation depending on us, okay? That's huge responsibility. But it also means that the flexibility means that we don't have certainty that we have. Because if we have one law and it applies to everyone without exception, then I can be certain that it's always going to be the case. But if I have this flexibility going on, right, now I'm not so certain anymore. And it's even worse for me because I'm a Gentile. So how do I know which laws actually apply to me, right? I mean, it gets really, really complicated in a hurry. And so yep. Hayes is trying to say, don't you see that the Greco-Roman world has a completely different view of law? It's not just that the Greco-Roman world believes in an ethics that's different than Moses. That isn't the issue. The issue is that the paradigm is completely different from a Greco-Roman perspective. A written law that comes from God is ipso facto not divine. It can't be because it's written and it's flexible. The only divine law has to be absolute and static, right? Like the law of gravitation. Okay, let's continue because we just barely got started, okay, in this book. It's going to get, the argument's going to get really, really interesting. Okay, so she says, this is right after that comment in red where it says Genesis 18, 23, and 25. She's talking about where Abraham negotiates with God. She says, this text has been cited as the most unambiguous example of a natural law type position in Scripture, right? Refers to doing what, it's supposed to be what, doing what is just and right as the way of Yahweh. And that's what Abraham says. Won't the God of all creation do what is just and right? Okay. If so, then Abraham does not call upon Yahweh to observe an independent principle of justice that he has momentarily chosen to ignore. Okay. He calls upon Yahweh to be true to himself. Shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly is a purely rhetorical question. Of course, is the appropriate answer, since both Yahweh and Abraham know that doing what is just and right is the way of Yahweh. Okay, so here's this really interesting, because what this suggests is that justice is whatever God does. Oh my gosh, can we live with that? Can we actually live with the uncertainty of the definition of justice so that it actually depends on whatever God does? And we don't know what God is going to do next as per Jonah, right? Is it just for God to send Jonah with a message of destruction to Nineveh and later change his mind completely? Is that justice? Well, according to this view, whatever God does is justice. So now I have to rely only on the character of God, not on the rules. Okay? So she goes on. The Hebrew worldview does operate on the assumption that all creation expresses God's law and moral purposes, and all of God's law is according to nature. What might be called the laws of nature in the Psalms are not considered in either impersonal or deistic fashion as in Stoicism. The laws of the universe are not independent edicts of an autonomous nature, but the direct corollary of God sending forth his word to the earth. So, does the Bible talk about the laws of nature? Yes. Are they independent of God? No. The laws of nature in the biblical sense only reflect the character of God. So, the laws of nature are no longer a judgment over how God behaves. They are simply a reflection of God himself. Okay, so there's this great line. Oh, go ahead.
That's scary, because could God make a mistake?
Yeah. Yeah. No. If Abraham is right, and that God only does what is just and good, then God can't make a mistake. However, from our perspective, it can certainly look like one. Because we come to the whole situation with a Greco-Roman background that says, wait a minute, these things, what is just and right should be rationally applicable, right? And then we see God do things that are completely irrational, right? Let me give you an example. In Isaiah, God says, I am the author of both good and evil. That should drive a Greco-Roman philosophically based theologian from the Christian world absolutely insane. Because how can a good God be the author of evil? Right? But that's what the text says. So now the Jewish view is, I don't understand how that can be the case, but if God says it, it must be true. Right? In other words, there isn't any need to try to reconcile these two clearly opposing ideas of good and evil. from the same source. Okay? The statement, of course, is about God's sovereignty. There isn't another divine power like Satan who's off going making evil things and God's in a battle with him. That's what Isaiah is saying is not. That's not the case. God is sovereign over everything, the good and the bad.
Because he has a purpose for what he does. We don't know the purpose, right?
Yeah, but Phyllis, here's the problem. If he doesn't tell you what the purpose is, you'll never know.
Right? No. And maybe we're not.
Because you're not, because in the Jewish world, you're not a Greco-Roman where you can noodle out with your own mind why God would do these things. You basically have to rely on the fact that you believe God is knows what he's doing. And even though it looks like a mistake or it looks like a contradiction or it looks like it's irrational, God must have a reason. Okay?
Right, but that's where trust doesn't sit
very well with Western people.
Right, but that's where trust and faith comes in. That's where we say we trust Paul and what he's doing, and that's it, right? What else can we do?
Yeah. Okay, but now see what you've expressed is the ideal Jewish believer who is an obedient servant, unquestioning. Okay, and that's what Hayes is saying, that in that arena, it appears as though the person who is most faithful is the one who does whatever God says without asking a question. But that's really difficult for a person in the West to come to grips with, because in the West, we follow Eve. Just tell me why, and then I'll decide if I'm going to do it.
But we still ask questions. We still ask questions.
Someone's got an open mic.
Your microphone is really bad, so I couldn't hear what you said. Dennis, do you have a remark before we go?
I was just saying, someone's got an open mic because I keep getting feedback.
It's Phyllis's mic.
It wasn't my mic. I don't think it was good. But anyway, what I was saying is, I said we can still, as a Jew, we can still ask questions, even though we follow and believe. We can still ask questions. We can still,
sure.
You know.
Ask as many questions as you want, Phyllis, but don't expect any answers. Okay.
All right. Skip, yes. Just want to mention, I don't know, when you were talking about God having creating both good and evil.
Yes.
Is that not contradictory to what Paul says in Romans, where you can't get bitter and sweet water from the same source?
Well, if it's contradictory, hallelujah, because now you're Jewish. I don't know how this works. I don't even know how you can say that God is the author of good and evil, but it certainly can be contradictory to what Paul says and still be within the, you know, within the body of the canonized text. I mean, it's interesting that you use that example, but there'll be plenty of other examples where we can find what appear to be contradictory statements. And this is what Hayes is talking about. If you define the divine law according to Greek standards, contradictions are a huge problem, because the real universal law has to be completely truthful, non-contradictory, and rational, right? So if I'm reading in the Bible and I read what Paul says and then I read what Isaiah says and it appears to be an outright contradiction, I know that that can't be divine law. It's got to be human law made up by human beings, because the real divine law must be uniform, rational, and true, right? It can't have contradictions in it. And you see this happening all the time in Christian theology, that they'll run across verses like the ones that you just suggested and say, okay, now we have to go through some kind of theological gymnastics to show why this isn't a contradiction. But from the Jewish perspective, from the Hebrew perspective, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
Just very difficult for us to come to terms with, right? Okay, let's continue with Hayes, because it's going to get... as she develops the argument, it gets more intense and deeper, and we start to see how much we stand with one foot on one side and one foot on the other, as I mentioned, okay? Let's continue. If an independent principle of justice is invoked in this story, she's talking about the Abraham story, then it is neither universal nor absolute, since Yahweh dispenses with it in response to Abraham's impassioned plea for forgiveness of the wicked, right? In other words, God says, God allows Abraham to negotiate, okay? The very fact that Abraham can negotiate means that there's flexibility, that it's not a static condition, okay? And furthermore, we see that God accepts some of Abraham's negotiated tactics, and therefore it appears as though the law of justice, which is uniformly applicable, doesn't matter. And God himself dispenses with the notion that justice is always the same. Okay? She goes on. The Deuteronomic association of the revealed Torah with wisdom and the Second Temple association of wisdom with the created order of nature set the stage for an identification of the Torah with the natural order, an identification that would enable the transference of attributes between the two. Why is that important? Because we know when this happened, right? We just finished this long study that says from Schiffman, what happened after the Babylonian captivity? Hellenism began to influence the rabbinic ideas, and the rabbinic ideas started to talk about a natural order, and the Deuteronomic association of Torah with wisdom allowed them to incorporate God into the natural order and make God look more Greek, right? Make God look like it was a reflection of what we see in the cosmos. But of course, as she said, that doesn't match up with the Pentateuch at all. That there are things happening in the Pentateuch that look completely arbitrary. Okay?
I find it also interesting that not only that God let Abraham negotiate with him, but that Abraham thought he could negotiate with God.
Yeah. Because guess what? Abraham knew that justice isn't a fixed idea. But of course, that's not the way we view it later. You know, give yourself 1,000 years and the rabbis are talking about something completely different. Okay? Let's look at Deuteronomy 13:1.
Skip just an introduction.
Yes, go ahead.
But this kind of justice can become a justice that has 7 billion facets.
Absolutely, because okay. Now you have justice that's arbitrary. Remember what the Greeks are saying? Mm-hmm. A universal law that applies, that a divine law has to be universal and static. It can't be arbitrary. But now you read the story from Abraham's negotiation with God and you realize it's arbitrary. Why did he stop at 5? Right?
Yeah.
The whole scenario is negotiating justice. How can you negotiate justice if justice is a divine principle enacted by God for all human beings? Right? You can't. But that's not the way the Pentateuch views it. The Pentateuch views it as something that I can, that's flexible enough for me to argue with God and get him to change his mind. And by the way, when he changes his mind, he doesn't grant Sodom an exception to the rule. Because when God changes his mind, that becomes the definition of justice. So we're stuck. We're stuck with, what do we do with this 7 billion circumstance in inherited flexibility, right? How can we ever say, but this is the rule? This is what God wants if there's 7 billion combinations of it. Okay? Let's go to the next citation. In the Second Temple period writings, the identification of Torah with wisdom entailed the transference of wisdom's biography to Torah, relying on Prophet 8. This further contributed to a perception of Torah, of Yahweh's law, as eternal and unchanging. The divine law may have been revealed at Sinai, but here it comes. You know this now from Schiffman. It existed with Yahweh long before Sinai, right? What do the rabbis say? The oral Torah was given to Moses at the same time of the written Torah. Therefore, the oral Torah, which has the flexibility in it, has just as much authority as the written Torah, and that's how they get around the issue of what happens with Abraham's negotiation with God. And she says, indeed, from the first moment of creation, wisdom has continued unchanged ever since. So what, and notice what she says, in the Second Temple period writings, okay? So this is not the Pentateuch. This is not the five books of Moses. This is the writing that happens in the Second Temple period. When is that? During the rabbinic period. What happened? The rabbis started to write as though they wanted the God of Israel to become like the Greek God of the natural order, so that they were looking for universal, static, true, you know, justice and laws. Okay, that shift. Remember, Shiftman talks about this a lot. What happened after the Babylonian captivity? What shift occurs? And now here comes Hayes without looking at Shiftman stuff and saying, oh, look what happened. In the Pentateuch, we have a completely different idea of who God is and what he does. But by the time we get to the rabbinic period, things start to change. Right? So she says, when judges in a non-legalistic society hear a case, they appeal to an abstract, generally religious sense of righteousness, okay, to support their rulings. They do not look to texts to authorize their rulings. The idea of law in these cultures is abstract, like the idea of justice, truth, and righteousness. Okay? That's the kind of society that we live in, the Greco-Roman society. When you hear people say, but the law applies to everyone, they're talking about an abstract idea. Okay? She goes on. Within legislative society, actual law is identified with written law. A law writing is more than a portrait of the law. It is the law. Actual law and written law are one and the same, right? So you can go to the law textbooks or the Constitution and argue from the written law what should be done. Law is written down and becomes a source of legal practice. The magistrate's task is no longer to discern justice, but to apply what the law writings prescribe for a certain kind of case, right? There it is, Phyllis. To apply what the law writings prescribe, okay? The same for everyone. In such a system, law is by definition a text. Law is no longer an abstract reality like justice, righteousness, and truth, but is textual by nature. Legal practice in such a society appeals to the texts as a source of ruling. This is really important because in the Greco-Roman world, that means that the law is human, not divine, because it's written down, because it depends on cases. It depends on, you know, how it was written, what the source was, who wrote it, all that kind of stuff, right? So she goes on. Athens established not merely the rule of law, but the rule of written law, law writings as a source of law. And then she says, Certainly the Israelite king is expected to execute judgment. He was to accomplish this, however, and this is important, not by consulting the Torah as prescriptive legislation, which is what a Greek would do, but relying on wisdom and discernment granted by Yahweh. The case of Solomon illustrates the point. In 1 Kings 3, Solomon asked Yahweh for an understanding mind to judge your people to distinguish between good and bad. But notice what Solomon doesn't ask for. He doesn't ask for a better Torah. Right? In other words, Solomon has the Mosaic Code, supposedly. Why does he need to pray an understanding mind to judge your people? He's got the code. All he's got to do is apply it. But you see the difference? In our society, we have mountains of legal precedent because we believe that legal practice, that law is based on what the writings say. Okay? But in the Hebraic world, it's not based on what the writings say. It's based on the relationship between the law, between the judge and Yahweh. If all I needed was the Mosaic Code, Solomon would never ask this in prayer, an understanding mind. He doesn't need an understanding mind. All he needs is a better application, right? So she says, law itself emerges from the king's wise and discerning judgment in actual cases. And of course, the real difference is in the Semitic Hebraic world, The law is determined by the actual cases, not by some abstract document or written principle. Okay? In the Greco-Roman world, human law is a function of written principles. In the Semitic world, it's a function of the king's last decision. Okay?
Skip, it's Bob. So that would go with where you had the rulings where somebody was sent to a sanctuary city, and then it would be rescinded after that person, after that judge died, then
yeah.
It reset itself.
And even more importantly, you couldn't go to a sanctuary city if you didn't have the right motivation. It's crazy, because how do you apply that, right? I mean, you look, the Semitic Hebraic idea, the basis of law is all in relationship, and relationship has this incredible flexibility to it. The relation in the Greco-Roman world, it has nothing to do with relationship. A real judge is one who's not influenced by human relationships and only does what the law says. Okay? So you can see that there's an enormous difference between these two. And we're going to stop here. But as we start to develop this, you're going to see more and more how the church aligned itself with the Greco-Roman world and then had to go back and try to explain why all this stuff was going on in the text. Okay?
Skip, my mind's going all over the place here now. I'm just thinking, is this a right statement, maybe? I don't know. That naturally we want a static law, but individually we seek out something more flexible?
Well, that's certainly the case for those of us in the West, right? We believe that the society will disintegrate if we don't have a static law. In other words, if we have a law that's completely flexible, depends on every certain circumstance, any individual can get a different judgment, we think society will collapse. Okay? Israel, by the way, didn't have that view. So in our view, take the O.J. Simpson case. In our view, we want the law to apply universally to everyone, even O.J. Simpson. He shouldn't get off just because he's famous. Okay? Yeah. On the other hand, we also want the law to pay attention to our particular circumstances, because we don't want it a universal application of the law when we believe that we have good reasons for our behavior. Okay? So we want both, right? In the Greco-Roman world, of course, civilization depends on the uniform application of an ideal, which is no interference by relationship. But in actual practical sense, the Hebraic world says that's not how it works. And what really happens is relationship. Unfortunately, in the Hebraic world, that means giving up the abstract principle. So we think the society is going to fall apart if we do that. And we have plenty of historical evidence to argue both cases. Okay? So what Hayes is helping us realize is how bipolar we are, right? We want a Bible that gives us the certainty of abstract rules that we know are going to hold our society together. And at the same time, we want the flexibility that we have in the relationship with God so that he doesn't treat us the same as everyone else, right? Look, you want a God who forgives you because you have all these individual personal circumstances going on and you have good excuses, right? But at the same time, you don't want a God who forgives everyone, right? It's crazy. And that's what Hayes is going to try to get us to see, how much we have in the West, one foot on the Greek side and one foot on the Hebrew side, and how much it's going to create conflict as we get into this. Okay. Okay. Let's just do two more citations, because I can see one that fits exactly with what we're talking about. It's only two down, and we need to make sure that we get that one in today. Okay. So the next citation is, embedding moral arguments in the very formulation of the law comports with the conception that the law is both accessible to reason and based on just principles transferred to the common sense, that the law is not mysterious, but entirely comprehensible is the explicit claim of Deuteronomy 30:11-14. But in fact, that claim, the book of Deuteronomy, and that claim doesn't seem to comport with what's happening in the rest of the Pentateuch. Now look at the next sentence. On such a view, the ideal human type is not the obedient servant, but the sage, the rational, moral agent whose study of the law leads to observance. That sentence describes what happens after the Babylonian captivity. Right? Up to the Babylonian captivity, God is expecting obedient servants. After the Babylonian captivity, the rabbis start talking about the sages, who are moral agents whose study of the law leads to observance. Okay? And we'll stop there. Okay, lots to think about until tomorrow. All right, any other comments before we sign off today?
Skip, it's Bob. Can I say, I'm not pushing anything. I'm just asking the question that people can think about it and not answer it today. But if that clubhouse option was open for another day, another time, another place, people go, yeah, we could sit and talk about it and da-da-da later as an option open. The time is not static. The flexibility of the platform and time is up to individual people. That's okay. Not a big deal, but just as a toss out.
Okay, good point. We'll raise the issue once more tomorrow. Anybody else have any questions about what we covered today? Nope. Okay, good. Good luck. I'll see you tomorrow. Yes, a question?
No, a comment, but it's kind of like a Trivial Pursuit sort of thing. When we're talking about Cain and, you know, the fact that, you know, there was not a written prohibition against murder prior to that. It was more of a, it's just something that you kind of knew or was known because of you were human that was.
How would you know it? How would you know that, Dave?
Well, you wouldn't. That's the same reason that you know, Cain and Abel also brought offerings to God. Well, there was no injunction to do that at that time.
That's right. That's right. The Pentateuch leaves all that stuff in mystery. We don't know how that all happened. Okay, I will see you all tomorrow.
Bye, everybody.